From Montana to Florida, Maryland to Arizona, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, will the next round of federal coronavirus stimulus include a bailout of states that were fiscally mismanaged before the pandemic? Adam Schuster from the Illinois Policy Institute is here to discuss. Unemployment levels continue to skyrocket as many states keep business closure orders in effect. Will jobs come back when the economy reopens? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Could the U.S. Postal Service be next on the bailout list? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at the latest report from the General Accounting Office. And trillions of dollars in federal stimulus borrowing is setting up the perfect conditions to trigger a deflationary cycle. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It's being called the Blue State Bailout. Large states with pre-existing financial problems are lobbying hard for trillions in subsidies in the next round of coronavirus stimulus spending. To explore the issue, we turn to Adam Schuster. Adam is Director of Budget and Tax Research at the Illinois Policy Institute. Adam, welcome to American Radio Journal. Adam, this next phase of the stimulus package 4.0, there's a lot of pressure to bail out, especially some of the larger states. And many folks are looking at it as a blue state bailout. Why should the federal government come to their aid now?
Even President Donald Trump, Senate Leader McConnell, have acknowledged that there's probably going to be more money coming to state and local governments to help them during the coronavirus crisis. It is true that revenue losses are being experienced by governments across the country, and everybody could use a little bit of help right now. But I think you're right to say that Illinois, and then in particular, you know, New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, some of these other deeply indebted, fiscally mismanaged states need that money a lot more than well-managed states do. So what we've said is there's kind of a compromise here. We don't want blank check bailouts. We don't want this money to go unencumbered or with no strings attached. But if there's financial protections in place that make sure the money isn't squandered and that you actually reform some of the underlying causes that got these states in trouble to begin with, then you can make this not so much of a bailout, but a financial rescue that also asks states to take a part in fixing their own problems.
Taking a look at this, then, the reason, the excuse, whatever you want to call it, for having the bailout is the coronavirus crisis. And the coronavirus crisis has obviously put pressure on state and local governments. There's no doubt about that. But is this bailout more a situation where the coronavirus is being used as the excuse to do it rather than as the reason? Because a lot of these states have been looking for a federal handout for a long time anyhow.
I think yes. I think there are many people calling for this money who really are using the coronavirus as an excuse. In Illinois, our financial problems were not caused by COVID-19. It was not caused by the recent economic troubles. They've been decades in the making. They're self-made problems, and Illinois just needs to be honest about that. But that said, this is an opportunity to fix those problems, and you can give a little bit of money to states to make up for lost revenues, but in return, you ask them to meet certain conditions to make sure that they're not asking for another bailout whenever the next crisis hits.
Congress is, of course, beginning to talk about this. Any clue yet as to what a potential bailout package might look like?
We know what one side wants. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi came out she wants $1 trillion, basically split between state and local governments, so $500 billion for the states and another $500 billion for local governments. And the mantra from Democratic governors, including the governor of my home state, Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, has been that they want the money to be unencumbered. They want no strings attached. So they just want a blank check from the federal government to use however they want. I think that the position on the other side has been a little bit more fluid. There's been talk of state bankruptcy. They backed off of that fairly quickly. And now I think people are starting to consolidate behind this compromise solution, which would be, you know, they do need some money, but obviously that's where the strings come in.
And what sort of safeguards would you envision being attached?
I think the safeguards need to be very narrowly tailored so that they're not stepping on states' toes with regard to federalism and states' rights and sovereignty and all those issues. It shouldn't be Congress coming in and imposing austerity or telling states to raise taxes or cut spending. But what they can do is put in place basic, you can call them credit conditions, that states have to meet in order to get the money from the federal government. So it's a voluntary process where states apply for, you know, either grants or low interest loans or something like that. And in return, they have to certify that they have sound pension systems. They can pay off their pension debt over no more than 25 years without increasing taxpayer costs, that they have truly balanced budgets, and that they have protections in place to make sure that they're saving for a rainy day. That rainy day fund saving is very important. Going into this crisis, the median state had about 8% of its budget held in reserve. Some states even had more. So, for example, Arizona had about 9% of its budget in reserve, plus a huge surplus that would have enabled them to absorb these revenue losses without cutting a penny or without asking for a dollar from the federal government. And so making sure that going forward, states are depositing in their rainy day funds when the economy is growing and they're not withdrawing from their rainy day funds when the sun is shining will make sure that in the next time a financial crisis like this hits, they should be in a better position to absorb the crisis and deal with it without having to come to the federal government.
You mentioned pension funds, and for many states, Illinois, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, a lot of the big states, pension systems are vastly underfunded and have been in distress for many years. That had nothing to do with coronavirus. So the potential bailout that is being developed in Washington, is it likely to include, because nobody knows for sure exactly what it will include yet, is it likely to include money to help state pension systems? And given that that had nothing to do with coronavirus, why would we do that?
I don't think it'll be part of the first round in terms of direct money to pension systems. Illinois' state Senate president, Don Harmon, did request, as part of his more than $40 billion bailout request, he wanted $10 billion directly to the state pensions. I don't think there's any way to justify that, and I think that's why you saw McConnell come out and say that he would rather allow states to go bankrupt than bail out their pension systems, which, like you said, have nothing to do with coronavirus. But beyond that, the reason we still think sound pensions should be part of the conditions, even if the aid isn't directly for pensions, is because, you know, if you take a state like Illinois, any money you give Illinois is going to prop up the pension system. Money's fungible, and even if you say it can't be used for pensions, you're still offsetting state revenue dollars that otherwise would have gone to other purposes. So we think that states need to grapple with the fact that, like you said, this is a self-made problem. They have unsound systems. They've promised more than they can afford, and if they're not in a position to be able to pay those promises off, well, then they need to reduce them to the level that they can actually sustain and afford. Otherwise, the federal government shouldn't give them money because they're not going to be financially sound.
We have been talking with Adam Schuster, and Adam is the Director of Budget and Tax Research at the Illinois Policy Institute. Adam, tell us a bit about the Illinois Policy Institute, and where can folks go to learn more?
You can learn all about us at illinoispolicy.org. The Institute is a 501c3 nonpartisan nonprofit. You could just call us a think tank. So we do public policy research based in the state of Illinois. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Just search for the Illinois Policy and we'll pop right up.
Adam Schuster of the Illinois Policy Institute. Adam, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. We're going to talk about the fact that the economy is doing so badly that unemployment continues to swell. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back with you, Loman. Thank you.
We have sort of briefly, Scott, over the last few weeks, touched on the unemployment situation. The numbers, however, continue to grow week by week in a rather dramatic fashion. Can you give us an overall picture?
Yeah, this week we learned that another 3.1 million jobless claims were made, and that brings the grand total during the coronavirus pandemic to about 34 million jobless claims. This is an astronomical element of the U.S. economy, and when you look at it in its totality, it is putting us in a situation where the pressure on service-based economy and all the hourly workers that basically bring us food and think about casinos and all the stuff in Nevada. We are facing a really dire economic situation, and how those hourly positions return to the U.S. economy is going to be contingent upon the atmosphere that states, local governments, and the federal government, quite frankly,
provide and allow for folks to get back to normalcy. So obviously, I have a lot of concern. I know that the 34 million people that are unemployed, they want to return to work, but will those jobs be available when it comes time to defeating coronavirus and rebuilding our economy?
We're starting to see a wave of bankruptcies, big companies even, like Gold's Gym in this past week, down to small restaurants in individual localities, all folding up shop. So having those jobs even come back, Scott, is more and more tenuous the longer these lockdowns go on. We're seeing sort of a patchwork of easing of those lockdowns. Do you see the trend accelerating over the next few weeks?
This week, I think we've seen an inflection point in reopening the economy. There was a woman in Texas named Shelley Luther, and she's a salon owner who obviously reopened despite the orders from her state. And when she faced down the judge gave her the chance to apologize in order to avoid a 7-day jail sentence. And she refused to apologize. She refused to take the easy way out. And she stood her ground discussing the reasons why she had to reopen. She's got employees that are having a hard time feeding their families. And I think that there's going to be a lot of business owners that are going to become defiant in the near term because, honestly, there's a lot of small counties in America that have only had a dozen cases in the entire county. It's not a pandemic in those areas.
What's interesting, too, about this story in Texas with Shelley Luther, Scott, is the fact that Governor Abbott himself has come out in opposition to the judge's sentence of Shelley Luther. So has the lieutenant governor, the attorney general. It seems like even the people who are putting these stay-at-home orders in place are saying, look, we've got to be a little bit bendable here.
Yeah, and I think that the guidance from Texas is that you're going to see all hair salons and barber shops open back up this week. So that's a good sign, right? We still want folks to be clean and safe and wash your hands, don't rub your eyes, follow the sanitary guidance that we're receiving from government officials, but that doesn't mean that the cure needs to be worse than the disease.
Meanwhile, back in Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives still has not come up with a plan to be able to reconvene. There's also some continuing discussion about the next phase, I guess 4.0 of coronavirus relief. What are you hearing on that front, Scott?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is having a really hard time putting together any sort of a plan that could be bipartisan. She's admitted to her conference that they're going to pass a bill eventually through the House without any Republican support. So I think that it's merely a messaging exercise, and it will put pressure on the Senate leadership and the administration to come together for another bipartisan package. Right now, what the Democrats are putting together in the House is going to be the largest response in terms of federal money. And right now, we're hearing Democrats say that this will be trillions of dollars once again added to our debt deficit. So when you're looking at hundreds of billions of dollars to state and local governments in the form of a taxpayer-funded bailout, when you're looking at additional money for federal welfare benefit programs, when you're looking at another round of Trump rebate checks, the Trump checks, when you're looking at additional money that will go to hospitals and frontline healthcare workers, the bill adds up. And we already know that we're on pace for a $5 trillion deficit right now. If we continue to add trillions and trillions of dollars in federal spending, it is not going to provide an economic situation where we can lead to a fast recovery. What we need to do is be thinking about pro-growth policies and reforms that are going to save the economy by speeding along the economic recovery. We're talking about deregulation. We're talking about tax relief that will actually help small businesses and job creators make ends meet. And I think that's why you've seen President Trump say that he's drawing a red line on the payroll tax cut. There's also, I think, a red line in the Senate where legislation will actually be drafted to include liability reforms so that when businesses do reopen, if somebody gets sick, whether that's an employee or a patron customer, those folks won't be able to engage in frivolous lawsuits.
Much to talk about as the next few weeks unfold. We are talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And as always, Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization in Washington, D.C. You can join for free by checking us out at clubforgrowth.org. And our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Another government-related agency on the financial rocks is the U.S. Postal Service. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from a new report from the General Accounting Office. Eric?
Thanks to a dramatic drop-off in mail volume, the U.S. Postal Service could lose as much as $13 billion this year. That's due in part to the coronavirus pandemic, but it's also a continuation of a trend that's been going for years now, where the Postal Service has racked up $78 billion in red ink since 2007. And a new report from the Government Accountability Office says that the U.S. Postal Service's fiscal path is unsustainable. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at this new just released report from the GAO. I know audits not necessarily the most exciting thing, but this one calling specifically on Congress to take action to deal with the Postal Service's problems. Now, as I said, the Postal Service has lost $78 billion since 2007. That's due to a decline in mail volume coupled with soaring pension costs. And the business model of the Postal Service is not financially sustainable, according to the GAO. That scathing report was released on Thursday, and it calls on Congress to reevaluate basically all aspects of the Postal Service's operations, including how often Americans receive their mail, and to consider whether the U.S. Postal Service should be restructured to receive annual infusions of taxpayer dollars. That is to say, whether the service should no longer operate supposedly self-sufficiently, but rather be rolled into the federal budget and be funded with tax dollars. This report comes at a crucial time for the Postal Service. In March, Congress extended a $10 billion line of credit to the post office as part of the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. That's the CARES Act, the big stimulus bill that was passed right at the end of March. That came after Congress had rejected an earlier proposal to include a $25 billion bailout for the Postal Service in the CARES Act. But now House Democrats are resurrecting that plan. They are asking for a $25 billion Postal Service bailout to be included in the so-called Phase 4 stimulus bill that lawmakers are currently negotiating, the text of which has not yet been made public. Now, due to the sharp drop in mail volume because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the U.S. Postal Service now expects to lose as much as $13 billion just this year, according to Postmaster General Megan Brennan. That's what she told the House Oversight and Reform Committee last month. President Donald Trump has been unwilling to bail out the Postal Service without getting reforms. Asked about it at a press conference last month, Trump said that the agency should raise its prices, actually by a lot. And then, he said, you'd find out that the post office could make money or even break even. But the new Government Accountability Office report makes clear that neither one-time bailouts nor higher prices for mail are going to be sufficient to fix the problems that the post office is facing. In the 10 years since the Government Accountability Office first classified the post office as a high-risk agency, the service's status has worsened due to declining mail volume, increased employee compensation and benefit costs, and increased unfunded liabilities and debt, the GAO says. Perhaps the best indicator of the Postal Service's structural problems is the divergence between the number of employees it has and the amount of mail it delivers. Since 2006, first-class mail has declined by 44%, and that was, of course, before the coronavirus pandemic. But the number of postal workers has actually grown during that same period of time. Also of concern is the growth of debt in the funds that are supposed to pay for pensions and other benefits for retired postal workers. At the end of 2019, the pension funds had about $50 billion in unfunded liabilities. That's the gap between what the fund has to pay out over the long term to beneficiaries and the amount of revenue that it expects to generate from workers' paychecks and investment earnings. The fund that covers health care expenses for retired postal workers is also deep in the red. It is facing a $69 billion unfunded liability. None of these problems should be new to lawmakers. The U.S. Postal Service reported a $4 billion loss in 2018, and Postmaster General Brennan warned back then that the agency could not generate revenue or cut enough costs to pay its bills. Rising prices have not staunched the flow of red ink. The cost of a stamp jumped by 10% in 2019, and other mailing services increased by 2.5% on average, but expenses have been outpacing revenues by a wide margin. In 2018, the Trump administration outlined two plans for privatizing the Postal Service in whole or in part, either by handing over management of the service to a private operator under federal oversight or by selling the Postal Service entirely through an IPO. Privatization of the Postal Service, which is something that my employers at the Reason Foundation have been advocating for literally over 50 years, would probably give the agency the ability to free itself from much of its current mess, which is largely the result of overlapping and sometimes unnecessary congressional mandates. Chris Edwards, the director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute, says that the Postal Service is stuck in a straitjacket because it's unable to save itself because Congress imposes restrictions on costs, pricing, labor unions, delivery, and other operational factors. He says that Congress should allow the Postal Service to implement long-needed reforms such as reducing delivery days, closing locations that have few customers, repealing collective bargaining, and other cost-saving measures. The level of debt within the post office makes privatization a challenge for sure, but not an insurmountable one. It would probably require significant restructuring and service changes before anybody would want to buy it, and the government would probably end up having to absorb most of the debt costs. But there would be a significant windfall for the government if it did sell off the Postal Service. One estimate from Cornell University suggests that a post office IPO could raise $40 billion. It would have been far better for Congress to have considered a plan like that prior to the current crisis that the post office is facing, but waiting any longer is only going to make this mess harder to clean up. Comprehensive postal reform has not taken place in part because of the difficulty in obtaining compromise from various stakeholders, says the Government Accountability Office in that new audit. It goes on to say that continued inaction will result in deepening financial problems, putting the Postal Service's mission to provide universal postal service at greater cost and minimizing the ability to make the most appropriate or sustainable policy decisions. Indeed, the longer you put off dealing with a crisis, oftentimes the worse that crisis becomes, and the coronavirus has just accelerated the problems that were already very apparent at the post office. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the post office, of pension issues, the national debt, the coronavirus, and all of that at Reason.com. And I'll be back here next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The federal government is set to borrow record amounts of money to pay for coronavirus stimulus programs enacted by Congress. But money is finite, so all that borrowing will have an impact on the economy. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has this week's American Radio Journal commentary.
Since the onslaught of the panic of 2020, the Federal Reserve has been moving to preserve liquidity in the financial markets. The central bank has reduced interest rates to near zero. 30-year Treasury inflation-protected securities are trading at negative interest rates in the United States. Denmark, Germany, Switzerland, Finland, and a host of other nations have been issuing short and now long-term government notes at negative interest rates since mid-year 2012, almost 10 years ago. Total worldwide negative interest rate debt from government now exceeds $16 trillion, and the U.S. may soon follow suit. The Federal Reserve has promised to infuse as much as $4 trillion in the United States economy in order to preserve liquidity and prevent the economy from seizing up during this COVID-19 crisis. The balance sheet of the Federal Reserve will grow from $6 trillion to over $10 trillion with only $39 billion of capital. No other bank in the United States would be permitted to have such leverage. All these steps are taken by all the central banks, including the Federal Reserve, to preserve liquidity in the market and to prevent a deflationary spiral. This dangerous precedent has happened before. In the United States, we moved into the world of quantitative easing of over $4 trillion with almost negative interest rates to battle the housing market fiasco in 2008. Prior to that, Japan experienced negative interest rates in the 1990s, and the European Union has languished in negative territory for quite some time. Alan Greenspan clearly understood the growing dangers of the economic world in his book, The Age of Turbulence, in which he explains a continuing saga of an increasingly turbulent world economy. Deflation is characterized by falling prices, falling incomes, declining value of real estate, and an inability to fund government debt and unfunded obligations. Deflation has begun, and governments continue to push the cliff date as far into the future as possible to battle the current economic effects of COVID-19. The $2.2 trillion CARES Act is absolutely the right thing to do at the right time. The Act preserves liquidity and cash flow to reboot the economy after the pandemic. It's a stroke of genius in the way it is structured for the most part. At the same time, though, the post-pandemic economy must deal with the Federal Reserve stimulus, negative interest rates, and out-of-control fiscal and monetary policy. With a crisis that follows the pandemic, will make all of the economic dislocations of the past 20 years look like child's play. The CARES Act and the Federal Reserve stimulus must be looked upon as a temporary measure to move us out of the economic shutdown caused by a pandemic. The underlying economy is strong, and as such, our post-pandemic government and Federal Reserve must operate with fiscal austerity to restore our financial arsenal for the future. Unfortunately, current fiscal and monetary policies of most Western nations are merely moving us further up the fiscal cliff rather than away from it. It's easier to spend more rather than disciplined in managing nations' financial affairs. The first economic victim of the pandemic will not be the consumer. It will be the host of municipalities already operating on the brink of financial disaster from the housing bubble. States like Illinois, Massachusetts, New Jersey, California will feel the crisis first. Other states will follow. Should the federal government fiscal and monetary policies become ineffective of bailing out the states, which is a dubious constitutionality anyway, the death spiral of deflation begins. Economic recovery will be difficult at best, because deflation spiral is so difficult to reverse. Buyers are rewarded with even lower prices by waiting to purchase goods and services. Deflation has devastating effects on every aspect of life. First, anyone with debt will find it more difficult to repay the debt in a deflationary cycle. Incomes and prices will fall, making debt repayment difficult or impossible. Second, organizations will have high fixed costs such as airlines, hospitals, automobile manufacturers, drug and pharmaceutical companies, governments, just to name a few. And they will find that the reduced prices that they need to have in order to cover the fixed cost is going to cause them to either lose customers or go bankrupt. While this strategy works in the short run by reducing prices, the economic consequences of lower prices will ultimately translate into lower pay, the deflationary spiral. Third, once this deflation cycle starts, the ability of a society to pay for things such as Social Security, retirement benefits, unfunded obligations, and any type of retiree health care costs will be impaired. The deflationary spiral will prevent any of these organizations from increasing prices. To avoid all of the negative issues of deflation, it is essential that our elected leaders and the Federal Reserve work immediately to eliminate uncertainty and reduce wasteful spending within our government. Failure to do so will lead to substantial deflation. The deflationary spiral may occur unless plans to restore solvency post-crisis are well known to give the lenders to government the confidence to know that the financial custodians of their debt have the financial will to restore solvency to government itself. The time to act is now. The age of turbulence will look calm in retrospect should government not act now to prepare for austerity on government spending once this pandemic is conquered. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXRA-AM in Alexandria, Minnesota, KAYQ-FM in Warsaw, Missouri, along with WWOW-AM in Conneaut, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.